Ellen Fanning with you for Life Matters in a program about good intentions. A little later we'll meet a worldly, educated French diplomat and doctor who allowed himself to become a vagabond on one of the world's most ancient religious pilgrimages. Not a religious man himself, he had no intentions, good or otherwise. For him, the road to Santiago in Spain turned out to be a truly transcendent journey, more Buddhist than Catholic, that led him deep into himself. But we'll begin with a young woman who at 19 was a force of nature, propelled by good intentions. Tara Winkler was so confronted by the plight of orphans she met in Cambodia when she was still that teenager, she established her own orphanage, only to conclude years later that in fact orphanages can do more harm than good. Tara Winkler joins me now. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Ellen.
It's an extraordinary story, yours. You're on holiday in Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
You go to this orphanage, and what do you see there?
Yeah, I was feeling uncomfortable, I suppose, being on holiday when I was 19, surrounded by so much poverty and just wanted to do something to give back. So I visited a few orphanages, but one of the orphanages I visited was desperately poor, and I had never encountered poverty like that before in my life. I was quite a well-travelled kid and had been to other developing countries, but the standard of living in that orphanage was shocking. They didn't have funds for enough food. They were only eating scraps from the monastery down the road. They were drinking dirty water. They didn't have any funds for medical treatment, and some of the kids in that centre had HIV, and I, at that stage, hadn't even met anybody with HIV before. So it was a hugely confronting experience for me, and I was compelled to then do something more to help.
And do you remember the children you met on that occasion?
Of course I do. I still know them all.
Who did you meet?
Well, Sinet Chan was one of the girls in the orphanage, and she was the one that ended up telling me what was going on behind closed doors. And she was one of the kids then that we rescued out of that orphanage.
And what did she tell you was happening?
She told me about the gross neglect, how scared she was living there and how much she wanted to leave. I didn't find out about the true extent of the abuse that was going on, which was that she was being sexually abused by the director of that orphanage. But in my absence and while I was not, I'd been volunteering that orphanage for a few months the year earlier, but when I came back, the kids were suffering such gross neglect in that orphanage that they were catching mice and things to feed themselves.
Eating mice?
Yeah.
Because there was no food?
Yeah.
But there were wealthy foreigners like you coming to orphanage.
And making donations. And this is part of the business model of some of these orphanages that are corrupt, is that donations are made, even donations of goods like rice and toys and things like that. And then those things are then embezzled by the corrupt orphanage staff.
So the orphanage becomes
a business.
A business.
And then the children are the commodities.
And who are they sold to?
Well, they're there. So the business model is to keep the kids as poor as possible so that it evokes sympathy from people like me who come to visit and then move to donate. And those donations are then embezzled, and that's the business model. So it's, but that's not all of the orphanages.
No.
Some of the orphanages do operate with the absolute best of intentions. But what we know from decades of international research is that even the very best institutions are harmful for children.
So there you are, and you've suddenly realised, because this young woman is telling you the truth of what's going on, and I guess there's a moment where you realise, well, heck, I'm part of this. If it wasn't for people like me with good intentions coming here to help and donate, this wouldn't be going on. How did you grapple with that?
Well, that came much later. So initially when I found out what was going on in the orphanage, I couldn't turn my back on these kids who I'd come to know and care about. And so I worked with a local team and with the local authorities to set up a new orphanage. So we rescued the kids out of that orphanage.
Now, hang on a sec. How old are you at this point?
I was 21 at that point. So, I mean, when that happened, when we made that decision to rescue the kids out, I was fully aware of the commitment that I was taking on that day, and that it potentially was a lifelong commitment for me, because I suddenly became responsible for 14 children's lives.
14. I mean, a lot of people would stand there and say, this is intolerable, something has to be done. Why did you decide that it had to be you, particularly when you were, as you say, 21, you had a job in film in Australia? I mean, you didn't have a background in dealing with trauma.
No, or child protection or anything. I mean, and that's part of the problem. But the reason was because I had no idea at that point how prevalent this problem was across the country. So when we went to other organisations to ask for help, nobody was interested. And I couldn't understand at that point why. Why, when there was this terrible atrocity going on in this orphanage, why nobody seemed to care.
What did they say to you when you said, now, hang on, you've got to do something. Sunita tells me she's being raped here. Fix it, fix it.
Well, I didn't know that she was being raped until after we had gotten her out of the orphanage when she felt safe.
But you knew how bad it was.
Yeah, I knew about the neglect and the physical abuse and that was going on and the conditions in that orphanage. But
so what was said when you raised the alarm? Because presumably your first instinct was not, well, I'll just move to Cambodia and adopt 14 children and we'll just take it from there.
Yeah.
So what did they say?
That they couldn't help, that getting involved was too risky. And now I understand why, because this is endemic across the whole country. And so this is not just one isolated incident in one really bad orphanage. So I didn't realize that at the time. And when I couldn't get anyone else to help and to get those kids out, I just worked with a local team, and Jetha, who I've been running, is the co-founder of CCT, and he's been running CCT with me ever since.
The Cambodian Children's Trust.
Yes. And so, we decided that was the only option, that was the only way forward.
And that's how you genuinely felt at 21, that, you know, confronted with what you knew and you couldn't unknow it.
and that really,
was the only option. Why? Just explain to me, why did the authorities say it's too risky to enforce the law?
It's a complicated issue. So in Cambodia, the government feel in many ways powerless to enforce their own policies. So to give you an idea of how that orphanage is still operating. Mm. So the orphanage that was abusing those kids is still in operation. So, I mean, that's what we're working with the government now. The government have an aim to reduce the number of children in orphanages by 30% over the next 3 years, which does involve closing down the orphanages that aren't operating to minimum standards, but it's just only something that's beginning now. So if I hadn't got those kids out of the orphanage, they would have still been there.
Mm. Yeah. My guest is Tara Winkler, author and founder of the Cambodian Children's Trust. So there are these 14 children. I'm trying to imagine the Skype call home to your mum and dad in Sydney. How did that go?
That my parents have always been incredibly supportive of me, and I've always been fiercely independent, and they didn't try to dissuade me at all, but I just,
Are you sure, dear? Was that part of the conversation?
I think they were proud of me for taking a stand, and I have no doubt that they were worried as well, but they hid that pretty well from me.
Mm. And where did you get the money that you needed for the work?
Initially, that first lump sum came from my grandma. So she gave me $20,000, which is what we used to start up the orphanage initially. But then it wasn't long. So once we'd got those kids out of the orphanage, it wasn't long before I realised that there were problems in that. So once I had been in Cambodia for about 6 months, I learned to speak the Khmer language fluently, and I could then communicate properly with the kids, and began to uncover some pretty strange things, which was that most of the kids that we'd removed from that orphanage weren't actually orphans at all. They had parents. And then the few that were orphaned had other living relatives, like grandparents and aunties and uncles and things.
So it becomes more disturbing as you go along. Take me back, though. Why was your grandmother sort of the logical person to provide the seed funding for this?
She just offered. So I had been in Cambodia the year before and volunteered, and she was proud of those efforts and things like that, and she wanted to contribute. So she had sold a house and had some money and gave me a gift of $20,000 for the kids. Yeah,
One of your grandmothers survived the Holocaust. Is that right? Was that this grandmother?
No, that's my other. I had two amazing grandmothers. I'm very lucky.
So one's provided, in a sense, the seed funding, and the other, in some sense, provides the inspiration. How so?
Well, both of them actually. So Joan, the grandmother that provided that money, is a social activist and is member of the Council for Civil Liberties and things, and has written some political books and things, and was a huge inspiration to me. And then my other grandmother, Nodgy, yeah, survived Auschwitz, and I grew up hearing stories of what it was like to experience the Holocaust and to survive the Holocaust. So then when I got to Cambodia and learnt of the genocide that had happened there, it resonated really deeply with me. And the kids as well that I've been working with are, like me, grandchildren of Holocaust survivors.
So you saw the echoes there.
Yeah.
It was a huge burden to take on in those years, caring for so many children. What do you know now about taking that on that you didn't know then?
I don't regret getting those kids out of that orphanage, and that is still what we're doing today at CCT, is helping to get children from institutions back home. And so I don't regret doing that. It was sort of the next steps that were, I suppose, the mistakes that I made in setting up another orphanage, which I then realised was not the right thing to do. So, I mean, those kids, once I could communicate with them properly, were telling me about how they missed their parents, and even some behavioural issues, like they were stealing money to send back home to mum and dad, worrying about them, and then feeling guilty about this great life that they were living in the orphanage. Meanwhile, their family can't even put rice on the table. Mm. So, and then also I had a psychologist, a child psychologist, come over and do some workshops with me and the staff about attachment theory, and really just educating us about, you know, that what we know that children need most in order to grow up to be happy, healthy adults is a secure attachment with at least one primary caregiver. And when they don't get what they're biologically programmed for, it can have a really serious impact on the development of human brain architecture. So,
and that comes back to the good intentions, doesn't it, Tara? I mean, you felt you had no option at that point. This year, lots of Australian school groups will go to places like Cambodia to work in orphanages. And as you say, there's research to show that much of the psychological harm suffered by children in orphanages is due to these multiple caregivers, people who come and go, you know, just another person to abandon you.
Imagine what residential care would be like for a child where, firstly, you have a constant rotation of caregivers, so someone new coming onto the shift every 8 hours. And then on top of that, you have a steady stream of visitors and volunteers coming in and showering you in love and affection, the love and affection that you're yearning for and should be getting from your family, and then leaving again, evoking all of those feelings of abandonment and proving again and again that you are not worthy of being loved.
Because they keep going. Yeah. They keep abandoning you. And so then there's somebody else.
That experience when you go and visit an orphanage and you see the kids and they run up and they cuddle you and they jump
in
your lap.
They look happy.
And they're giving you cuddle and they're really cute and friendly. That's a symptom of an attachment disorder. It's not a normal thing for a child to want to climb into a stranger's lap and give them a cuddle. That is a symptom of an attachment disorder. It's a coping mechanism for children who are in institutions who are vying for love and attention.
So, I mean, you had this realisation from the psychologist, and then there've been many UNICEF reports, but one in March 2011 showing that the number of orphanages in Cambodia had doubled in 5 years. Only 28% of the kids were actually orphans, and as you know,
Yeah, that's right.
And as you know now, a lot of this increase was due to this funding from overseas, funding that actually contributed to separating children from parents.
Yeah.
You know, when you have all this realisation that you've been maybe doing the wrong thing for all the right reasons, gosh, what impact does that have on you?
I mean, it was a slow realisation, but then...
There wasn't a light bulb moment where you went,
not really. Oh. So, you know, for me, I realised that, okay, the kids in this orphanage weren't orphans. And then when that UNICEF report came out, I realised, geez, it's across the whole country, this problem. This is an endemic issue across Cambodia. And then I realised that it's not even just a problem that's isolated to Cambodia. This is a global issue across the developing world. We've seen a boom in the number of institutions and the number of children being institutionalised.
And were you listed in this UNICEF report?
Yes.
CCT?
Yeah.
Cambodian Children's Trust?
Yes.
So were you part of the problem?
Yes. So, I mean, and that was, you know, I had to eat a big piece of humble pie to admit that I'd made a mistake in that way and been a part of the problem, and in that I'd been an orphanage tourist and a voluntourist, and then I set up my own orphanage and then facilitated orphanage tourism in order to generate funds for the orphanage before I knew better.
And how did you feel when you allowed that, the full weight of that realisation, to strike you?
I felt moved to change what we were doing.
You've said in the past, mild moments of despair.
Yeah. I mean, it was confusing as well, like because of the fact that we're operating in a different culture and a different languages and different customs. And so you're trying to sort of navigate a very foreign world, you know. And I think, you know, when people hear the statistic that there's 8 million children around the world living in institutions like orphanages, despite the fact that over 80% of them aren't not orphans. They have families who could be caring for them. I think a lot of people sort of ask, you know, how could this happen? Mm. How could this happen without the world knowing? Mm. And I think, I mean, the answer is really quite simple, that who is easier to silence than a child? So this is, you know, a crisis really happening across the developing world.
Mm. And do you think, I mean, we'll talk now about the work of the trust now, but do you think in those years you did any harm? What could be more harmful than leaving a child to be raped in an orphanage?
I do not regret getting those kids out of that mm. orphanage and out of that institution. And that is a big part of what we're doing today, is helping orphanages to change their model, or and helping children who are living in orphanages and institutions to go back to their families. The other thing about this issue is that, you know, because of the vast majority of children living in orphanages are not actually orphans, then the term orphanage is really just a euphemistic name. So this issue applies to organisations. There's lots of different euphemistic names mm. that are used, so shelters and safe houses and children's homes, children's villages, even boarding schools. Mm. So we're helping kids from those institutions go back home. And so we're doing much of that work. The big mistake for me came from, A, the initial volunteering that I did. I didn't realise the harm that comes to kids when you go and you spend that sort of time with them and you leave, and how that impacts a child's development.
And I'm also, I mean, struck by how much you've been through in your young years. I mean, I think, what was the total number of children that you were, in a sense, mum to when the orphanage model was running? Was
so
it 27?
No, it grew up to about 40, because right. initially what we started doing, when I realised that these kids weren't orphans and they had families and they missed their families, it didn't make sense to me, because even imagine, like, if the kids do get through that system unscathed, so they get a good education, mm. they can go and get a good job. It's not likely, because we know that growing up in an institution is harmful to a child's development, and they'll have difficulty forming relationships in adulthood and reintegrating back into society. But even for the kids that do get through it unscathed, they still don't escape the cycle of poverty, because they'll be forever supporting the rest of their family who is left behind.
Yeah.
Because in Cambodia, family is really important. In Cambodian culture.
So complex. And then you're having to deal with the day-to-day, not only the tragedy of the country and the system and all that's stacked against you, but, you know, you actually lose a child. A child drowns through no fault of yours or your carers, just one of those terrible, tragic things mm. that you would think could undo you forever.
Yeah, that was the worst day of my life.
What happened?
We were on excursion, and our whole team and organisation was there, and one of the little kids, she's a cheeky little thing, and she decided to, as we were packing up to go home, she took off life vests and jumped in the big pool, and it was just too late by the time we got there. So that, yeah, did nearly destroy me.
Yeah. How old were you at that stage?
I would have been 25. Yeah, 24, 25.
And did you think at that point, oh, that's it, I've got to go home, I can't do this?
Well, funnily enough, I didn't go home after that, because my partner, for a short time, because my partner then was diagnosed with cancer a few months later, so I came back to look after her and nurse her until she died 9 months later. So
it's a lot, isn't it?
Yes, it's been a big, big decade for me. Mm. Yeah.
You now have a very different model for this organisation, a community development model. How is that different?
Well, I think the thing is for CCT now, we are proof that care reform is possible. So we were an orphanage, which we know is a big part of the problem. And in 2012, we finally closed the orphanage and changed the model in favour of family-based care. So
you've got to go out and find foster carers or find the children's biological parents.
That's right.
And what, just structure it, so scaffold them so that they have the means to raise these children.
So what we did initially was we set up foster care first, and then we moved all the kids from the orphanage with their only with their biological siblings into a foster family. And from there, then we do the process of family tracing. So we go and find the families.
Oof.
And then once we find the families, we do risk assessments and family assessments and work out what the problems were that caused that family to be separated in the first place. And then we solve those problems, and then the kids, then begins the process of family connection. So for a lot of the kids, they have been separated from their families for a really long time. So we give them the opportunity to just get to know their parents and their family again. So that we never push them. It's always led by the child. And so they might just start spending weekends with their parents, and then it's always up to them, and they always decide eventually when they can see that the rest of their life doesn't change, that they always choose to go back to live with mum and dad. Mm. But then we run community youth centres where these kids come every day. So whether they're living with their biological parents or in kinship care with relatives or in foster care, these kids come every day where we provide nutritious meals and clean drinking water and education support. So we support them to attend public school, but then we run supplementary education programs as well as life skill classes and counselling. And then their families receive support as well. So with income generation or access to employment, support groups like with for alcohol or parenting skill workshops and things like that. So it's a holistic model. It's a holistic approach, and it's case specific to every family. Mm. And this model has actually been so successful over the last 5 years that it's now being put forward by UNICEF Cambodia and our development partners and the Cambodian government as a national solution to keeping children in families.
It's been an amazing journey, and you tell the story with such humility. You've written this book. It's called How Not to Start an Orphanage by a woman who did. I imagine the proceeds go to the Cambodian Children's Trust.
Yes,
you're nodding away. Thank you so much for coming and telling me about it.
Thanks for
having
me.
And I'd commend the book to the listener. It's published by Allen and Unwin. You're listening to Life Matters.
Want to hear about the best party in town this election season? It's a new podcast with me, Frank Kelly.
And me, Patricia Carvelis.
The Party Room, your essential guide to this federal election. Subscribe now. Simply search for The Party Room in your podcast app.
Or listen via the RN website, abc.net.au/RN.